It's Monday, November 27th, 2006, and you're listening to episode 29 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 54 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and sitting across from me, ready to drop his britches,
zip,
is Chad. And moving around from Chad is Adam.
Hi, boys.
It was the reason our last show, our last recording of this episode.
The second one?
Yeah, the first of the last two recordings of this episode, because Adam promised that he was going to do that whole episode naked, and we're grateful he didn't, but because he didn't, all the karmic wheels were spinning against us.
This time there were no promises, so no broken promises.
Let's explain that a little bit. We are on take three.
Of this episode. Yeah, it's been a difficult transition for us because when Fear the Boot kicked off, obviously it was about role-playing advice, which was a subject that we had thought about, talked about.
We've been discussing this for years.
In fact, we've talked about even before podcasting existed, we talked about we should write a book or something on how to do a role-playing game correctly. So when we turned the mics on, yeah, there were some organizational issues, and we kind of had to figure out how exactly to make the show flow. But overall, things mostly took care of themselves. We just had to get the pacing down a little bit. But this has been a very different series for us for really two reasons. One, we have not talked about writing role-playing games the way that we've talked about running role-playing games.
And we've discussed it, sure, but not on the in-depth level.
Right. Not as micro as we want to get.
Right.
And secondly, because of the fact that this is a new topic, we're having to figure out how to approach it. And I think where we were headed with the previous two recordings of this episode is we were trying to kind of walk everyone through, here's how we're designing Skies of Glass.
A lot of cold hands. And
really, that's not what Fear the Boot is about.
Nah.
Fear the Boot, really.
We're not taking it by the balls.
Yeah, exactly. And even the positive advice we give usually is spawned by
someone's bitching.
Some negative experience.
What are you looking at me for?
I'm looking at you.
I mean, when we talk about the group template, the group template did not come because we were good, studious children who had great gaming practices. It came because we had too many games go south.
Right.
We've seen too many games go south, and the group template is what fixes those. And that's the sort of approach I think we need to take to game design, is to end with advice,
right,
to have the whole way through best practices, but to keep our eye on what Fear the Boot is good at, which is
negativity.
Negativity. Raw, burning hatred.
That's right.
I am on fire.
All right. Let's do some quick announcements then so we can drill down to...
Quick announcements for the third time. Dan, hit it. Go.
I know. They could probably recite these for me. First of all, we've had a couple of people ask if we're going to bring Tex back on the show.
Nope, never.
I'm mad.
I made that joke the last two times, too.
Yes, he did. And yeah, it was funny then, and it's funny now.
That's why the episodes fail.
I'm mad at the son of a bitch because he came into St. Louis and got me sick, and I'm one of those people that never get sick, but I guess anything he has, I'm genetically predisposed to be vulnerable to, if that even makes sense.
I don't think it does.
But
no, I think you just got the cold that's going around.
No, we're stopping.
Keep rolling.
My version of events is better. It has me powerful and impenetrable with some Achilles heel that comes from within my own family. There's a great movie there.
That's right.
There's a great character there. You should play him in the next game.
It is an awful character.
And we should not play him.
I slide you
the
new character sheet. I say, fill out a new one. Give me yours. You're the bad guy now.
But the answer is, yes, Tex will be coming back. In fact, we are trying to get him on the show via Skype. We were going to do it for one of the takes of this episode. We just had to be sure the quality was there. We've got the quality, but then I screwed up and bought the wrong splitters. So everyone on the headphones, some people were hearing Tex, some people were not.
Some people were hearing Barry White.
Some people were hearing Barry White. Other people were hearing actual bears.
Yes.
It was a very confusing setup. We don't know what happened.
George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars.
Really?
Yes.
I am jealous.
Did she get George Clinton pregnant?
Maybe.
Whoa. Moving on.
The spawn of Dawn and Funk.
Moving
wow.
on.
All right. We have an Xbox Live contest going on for those of you that caught the last episode. When Tex was in town, he brought with him some great prizes we're giving away. All you have to do is go to feartheboot.com/contest. Just type in a little bit of information, hit enter, And once a week, we are going to pick a random winner. After we pick a winner, we wipe the database out. So you need to come back once a week and re-enter. Now, if you tried to enter this past Saturday or Sunday, you may have been told you're already entered. That was my bad. I forgot to wipe the database. So go back and
that's
enter again.
So many days.
Now, our winner from this past week has selected the neon sign, stadium blanket, and hat prize package. However, we still have in the mix the three games, which are Need for Speed Most Wanted, Burnout Revenge, and the Xbox Live Arcade Unplugged Collection, which has six games on it. You can listen to last episode if you want to know those games.
Yes, congratulations, Faith.
Yes, congratulations, Faith.
And
Faith,
we don't know you at all.
I'm glad
total
our winner...
stranger.
Demand a tithe of the hat.
I'm glad our winner was local, because honestly, I have no idea how I was going to mail that sign. I mean, it's packaged up pretty well. But to put the hat and the blanket in there, I'd still have to repackage it in something else. So in a way, this works out.
You don't want to ship that thing either.
All right. But Faith, having won, is now out of the contest. She is kicked off the island. Please keep on entering. Three more prizes to go. The form is up and ready to go. Chad, WoW Guild, in 15 words or less.
Black Hand, PvE, Alliance side. Fear the boot.
We're up to seven.
Love it. Live it. It's on fire.
It was like 16.
Well, it depends on whether you count it's as two words or one, but actually he came pretty damn close.
I count as one.
Well, of course you do.
Did I make it?
I think so, yeah. Actually, you did make it.
It's is one word.
Yeah, so very good, Chad.
Thank you.
Great community over there. We're having a wonderful time on the guild.
Yes.
If you play WoW, don't play on that server, have played WoW, have never picked up WoW, pick up the game, Black Hand server, mm-hmm. It's a PvE server, Alliance side, stop by and say hi.
Burning Crusade's getting ready to come out, new races, new trade skills, so if you haven't played WoW before, now would be a great time to pick it up, get used to the game, and try out one of the new races when they come out.
All right, you know, of the many little side stories we told in the previous takes of this episode, including things about Dawn setting her Barbies on fire and such...
All lost forever.
The one story that we have sufficient people here to retell, and I think is worth retelling, is this guy you ran into at McDonald's.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Nice young man. Interesting young man. I was, before the episode, we had talked about the actual redo of the episode. We talked about, oh, we're going to go out and we're going to get McRib. McDonald's is running their McRib
sandwich
extravaganza.
Yeah.
And
Rib extravaganza.
Yes. I stopped by, none of these yahoos did, and so I'm sitting there by myself alone and crying. I had taken one of my War Machine books. I start reading it and such, and I'm eating my McRib and whatnot, and this employee of McDonald's, this young man, comes over. He's kind of pushing a broom, and he's looking over, and he's pushing a broom. He's like, hey, man, is that a role-playing game book? What game is that? I'm like, oh, it's War Machines, tabletop miniatures game. It's this, that, and the other, and... No, it's based on a role-playing game. He's like, oh, that's cool, that's cool. Goes off, does some work, kind of comes back. He's like, oh, yeah, man, I play D&D, and it's really cool and stuff, and yada, yada, yada. This, and then I'm like, oh, yeah, we start talking back and forth. He's asking me about War Machine, and I'm telling him what I know about the role-playing aspect of it, and talk about there's a local hobby shop down the street, and he should go check that out, War Machine and whatnot. And he's like, oh, man, you know, we're looking for people in our group. Here's my phone number and name. Give me a call if you're interested. We could teach you how to play D&D.
Oh,
and I'm like,
you do not know what you have to get.
Flares up like fire behind your head, and you punch him in the face, knee him in the groin, and it's like, boys, I wrote Fear the Boot Compliant.
In reality, I'm like, oh, I've played D&D plenty of time. I've played it quite a bit, but I'm part of this podcast on role-playing games. You know, I write down the feartheboot.com on a napkin, and I hand it to him, and he's like, oh, wow, that's really cool, man. I'll check that out. So
if you're listening to the show, did you catch his name?
Yes.
Okay, and you don't remember it?
No, I have it written down in my pocket. I know exactly what it is.
And it
but
is.
I don't want to embarrass him.
Okay, all right.
You know, I don't know.
Well,
this gentleman,
Mr. So. Whatever your name is that Chad met while eating his McRib, welcome to Fear the Boot. Glad to have you aboard.
Indeed.
And we're sorry that people teaching you how to make bombs apparently
has
ended your role-playing experience.
That's the other story, too. Is again, I hope I don't embarrass him too much.
We haven't given a name yet.
Yes, exactly. He's like, oh, yeah, I actually don't really play D&D anymore. My mom doesn't let me. I'm like, oh, that sucks. And I'm expecting some, you know, the
religious argument
or something.
Or whatever.
And he's like, oh, yeah, it sucks. And, yeah, I had this friend, and I'm assuming the friend was like, just I get from it is that the guy was in the military in Iraq, my friend is a demolitions expert. And, you know, we were talking, as young men generally do, share exciting stories and whatnot. He's telling me about bombs and explosives and his job and whatnot. My mom got freaked out. She thought that I was going to start making explosives and bombs and whatnot. She's like, you can't play D&D with those guys anymore.
What? Roll for explosive making.
So it turns out that more than some kind of religious issue, this was just a generic, you can't talk to Billy anymore sort of thing.
You can't blow up things for freedom anymore.
This is one of the great things about being an old man like I am, that now if like somebody says to me, well, I don't want you talking to so-and-so because they're bad influence, my response is get off my property before I call the police. Which hopefully you don't get there with your parents. I actually have a great relationship with my parents.
No, you don't.
No, you're actually horrible. I do. Speaking of which, over this weekend, I became an uncle.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congrats.
My sister and her husband had their baby. And actually, you guys may be hearing you may be hearing her husband's voice fairly soon, because he and I are talking about starting up a side project, which I need to tell actually you guys more about. You're staring at me blankly. So
this is why you have so many problems with your overextension.
Oh, no, no. This actually fits right into things we're doing right now.
Stop. This is right up there with the bouzouki.
You know what? I have about half an hour of free time a week. That's half an hour I could be doing something.
I have negative 3 hours of free time. Man, I really want to take up square dancing. Let's shoehorn that into my
and
already
I do want to learn square dancing.
Hectic he is
lifestyle.
Learning square dancing while hosting a podcast.
That's right. Do-si-do.
The king of multitasking. Do you know I didn't become an uncle until I married Dawn?
Oh, yeah. Her sisters, yeah. I guess, have...
Well,
her instead of
I'm an only child, it would be impossible.
Yeah, you couldn't become an aunt or an uncle. Well, I don't know.
Unless... I don't think I could ever become an aunt.
Did well, you know that I have an uncle who is 16 years old?
You could in California.
You really?
Yes.
Step and all that, or married in, or... Yeah. I don't understand.
No, my mother's father remarried, so it's not a step-uncle. And then they had a kid after I was born.
Huh.
So he's 16 years old.
Wow.
He's like 4 foot
tall. Do you sit on his knee and try and get uncle-y advice?
We don't really talk
advice?
About the family.
Yeah, when you sit on your uncle's knee, it's not usually advice you're about to get.
Oh!
Let's move into the topic. Wow!
2 episodes burned and he's getting saucy.
I'm on fire. All right, let's, real quick, for those of you that are just joining us for the first time, shame on you. And
nice. Whoa.
Now moving forward, We are in rare form tonight.
I'm in rare form tonight.
Right. We're not usually this sassy.
Well, he's not.
For those of you that, yeah, no, I'm usually the mild one keeping you guys in line. And anyway, the next several months of this podcast, what we are going to be doing is moving away from advice on how to conduct a role-playing game and move into advice on how to write a role-playing game. We are using, sort of as an object lesson illustration for this, a post-nuclear game we have created called Skies of Glass, which we are going to be releasing in parts on the resources section at feartheboot.com. So stop by there after the podcast to pick up relevant literature from the previous show.
And there
show.
Will be literature up
for the show.
This content.
There will
yeah.
be for this one as well.
I said after this contest.
You
after
did.
This episode, yes.
There will be after the contest, too, but there will be also after the show. So stop by and pick that up. And actually, if you've never been to feartheboot.com, we'd love for you to stop by in general, just to say hi, stop by the forums, whatever.
Very, very active forums and
it's
great
a
community.
Great community over there. We have a lot of cool people over there. I love talking to the guys. They have interesting things to say. So please do stop by and say hi. We'd love to have
Except
you
Except for that
there.
Obo cop guy. I don't know what's up with him.
Yeah, I got some opinions. The Fear the Boot legal team upstairs has advised me to stop making slanderous remarks because we don't want to get sued any further than we already did.
I thought it was a jerk's name changed colors the other day. Draw attention.
Yeah,
to
Blue Obocop.
Yep.
Blue Obocop. Blobocop. And that's just sick. And we don't like that kind of person hanging around. The subject we're going to get into today primarily is going to be feel. But before we do, we have two little stops to make
Feelings.
On the way. The first is a strong praise for a service that is helping us develop this game.
And they pay us a nickel every time we say it.
If they did, we'd be wealthy. For those of you who don't know, we're developing this with the three of us, John, who is right now still in Rome, and also we're getting some help from another fellow who is living, I believe, in Iowa right now.
Some godforsaken, blasted country.
Yeah. Because of that, it's a little hard for us to coordinate the work we're doing. And quite frankly, even if we were neighbors, just having jobs and families and social engagements, it's hard to keep track of that stuff. Plus, if you get the coincidence of people working on the same document at the same time, mm-hmm. it's hard to share your work.
Revisioning. Yeah.
Unless you want to set up a SharePoint server, and that's painful experience in and of itself.
Well, we also figured out in a previous take of this episode you could use Visual Source Safe, but that seems like overkill as well.
Yeah. Why not use something that's free and already set up and infinitely
like
secure?
docs.google.com.
There you go.
So if you go to Google Documents, which is at docs.google.com.
Thank you, Google and Sun Microsystems.
Yeah.
No kidding.
They have a wonderful document system where you can create documents. You can share them with anyone that has Gmail account or a Google mm-hmm. account. It's neat stuff. You can get in there. It shows you who else is editing the document at the same time. It will actually refresh live. So, like, if you're watching a document and someone's writing, you'll see their words appearing.
It's awesome. When we very first set up, somebody was writing a short story in there, what we're calling drabbles, but really aren't the technical term of drabbles. But anyway, they were writing a short story in there, and I was sitting there watching them type this out. Every few seconds, a new sentence popped on the screen. And he knew I was watching him because my name was on there, too, that I was doing this. And Adam, I think you were saying that you were watching me create a document or something like that.
What I like is on the revisions tab, you can flip over, and it has a backwards chronological list of every single change
every
made
revision.
To the document.
Yeah.
When you click down the list, it highlights the section in a different color, and there's a key for all the contributors for the document.
Right.
And so you can see what changes were actually made. It's hot.
Mm-hmm. And what we're doing to make it even a little bit easier is as we converse on those, we've each picked a different color that we're using to put
I'm
our
comments. Green.
Yeah. I'm gay purple.
You are gay purple. I'm red. I guess what John picked, brown.
Ew.
You picked gold.
He picked gold. No, he even said it's the color of a fresh poo or whatever. I had some comment to that effect. But anyway, so I highly recommend that. Now, speaking of docs.google.com and the things that it has led us to do, all this came from the fact that we have a team that's writing this RPG. So one of the things I want to talk about, and actually I wish we had hit this in the previous episode, but we didn't, and we can't go back in time and fix it. So what we're going to do instead is hit it here. When you are doing an RPG, we would highly recommend assembling at least a small team of people. And the reason that we recommend this is, well, actually quite a few. First of all.
Oh, a numbered list.
Oh, yeah. It offers you some additional perspectives. If you think about an RPG, it's meant to convey a potential for broad experiences,
right.
A game that many people could play in many ways. And, you know, even if you're talking about something more limited like a novel.
Well, a novel is like one vision.
But even still,
a novel is not interactive.
Hey, a novel is written.
A novel is written, but not to be interactive.
But even even non-interactive, with a novel, you are still typically trying to capture many characters and a lot of things going on. And so it's helpful when you're writing just to have another perspective, just to have people get in there and say, you know, maybe you should do it this way, or this just isn't the best way to handle this, or wow, did you think about developing this, or whatever, just get in there and give you some kind of feedback. Similar to that, you need a creative editor. Someone just to step in and say, look, not just suggest improvements, but hey, this just isn't going down right.
Or even maybe to say, you've got a good idea going on here. Here's some input on what I think that can make this an even better idea. Or let's do some very micro brainstorming to make these one or two concepts even better.
Technical editing is another place. And I mean technical editing both in terms of just looking for spelling and grammar errors, but also looking at like the rules mechanics and such, making sure you haven't left any big gaping holes in your rule system. We tried to sketch out kind of what we consider to be the critical roles for developing a role-playing game. Before we give those, we want to say that you're obviously going to have to work with what you have. So you may not be able to fill all these roles. And depending on what you're doing, you may not even need to fill all of the roles. For example, if you're just making something for you guys to enjoy in your friend's basement, you can be as professional as you want to be, but you don't have to. You can choose to do this on one guy in a spiral-bound notebook, which is how we have done some of our games in the past. But we are going to lay this out as if you were trying to go for full high-production value RPG. And we came up with five major roles. One is a creative director. And also, by the way, these roles, you could have multiple people in the same role, and one person in multiple roles.
Mm-hmm.
We would recommend one and only one creative director. This
is the guiding light of the whole project.
Yeah, someone that brings a sense of unity and direction to the whole thing. This is probably the guy or girl that came up with the idea for the RPG. Doesn't have to be. Someone that is willing to hold on to and steer the development, but someone who will hold on loosely. Someone who's willing to let other people say, you know, this was a great idea, but this really wasn't. The second thing is the content writers, the people that write the creative backstory, the fluff, the setting, all that sort of stuff. Definitely need at least two of these just for the joint perspectives.
Minimum two.
Minimum of two, probably more.
I think everybody on this team is going to end up doing this job at some point.
And I think they should. And I think they should. The next one on here is the rules writers. Mm-hmm. One, at least two of these.
We're talking rules writers. We're talking the math guys.
The math. This is what a character is. This is how a gun fires. This is how persuasion rolls go down.
You definitely need two of these guys, and these guys need to get into heated arguments over everything.
Yeah.
Honestly, in a strange sort of way, they do. Artists. If you're going to go for production, get some artists in there so you can illustrate the world. Chances are your world has a lot of concepts that simply aren't real.
Mm-hmm. More than one artist.
Yes.
Very important.
You need multiple artists conveying multiple styles. Even if you say to the artist, well, I want your style to be very generic. I want it to be very realistic and illustrative and stuff. It's still each artist has a very specific generic style.
Style, right.
And you want to capture multiple aspects. I mean, feel is like a multifaceted jewel here. And each one of these things capture those facets. Artists are one of those things. There's multiple facets that have to be captured by the artists and such. Also, I don't know, you might not have this problem in your circle of friends, but we definitely have it in ours. There's a drought of available artists who can actually produce.
Yeah, that's a big catch there, is artists that are both skilled and reliable.
Yeah. We've known plenty of people who have talent. Well, they have skill, but they have no talent. For me, talent means that you have skill that you do something with. And we have met plenty of people who just sit on their laurels and talk about how wonderful they are, but never demonstrate it.
Hey, jerk, I'm busy.
With drawing!
Oh, never mind.
You know, that's something, quick aside here, I tell you, one of the most difficult things of doing a role-playing game is, and just like any other creative endeavor, is having the self-discipline to actually do it.
Right.
It's a ton of work. And I'm glad we have a team for another reason, which is that it creates a certain amount of healthy peer pressure. You're accountable to somebody. Mm-hmm. Somebody's expecting your work, and somebody else is saying, hey, where's your contribution? And so it would take, ideally, the majority of this team giving up and imploding before the whole project would fizzle.
Right.
And I think it's also helpful in our case that we have the podcast at our backs, where we
have to see these jerks once a week anyway.
Well, I don't mean that. I mean, we have the pressure that the show is following this product's development, so we have to keep developing the product.
Yeah, I got a thousand people who are looking over my shoulder.
Because otherwise we have to sit down, like you said. I mean, we're up to about 1,000 listeners an episode.
And by 1,000, he means 10.
No, by 1,000, I mean
1,000.
I mean 1,000. And we'd have to sit down at an episode and explain to 1,000 people why we didn't bother to do the work.
Oh, by the way, to all those 1,000 listeners, thanks.
Yes, thank you. Welcome to Fear the Boot.
That's Adam. He's into furry porn.
Yes.
Hi.
All your furry porn to Adam.
I got new furry porn the other day.
Did you?
Really?
Anything
from
good?
Some guy I didn't even know.
Wow.
Like, I don't even know
what's
who this
his
guy
name. Is. You don't even know his name.
No, I don't even know his. Well, I know
well,
his
let's,
name.
Let's
but,
not put his email address.
Thank you, mystery man.
Yes. Thank you.
Was it naughty?
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Excellent.
I opened it up at work. I'm like, what the hell is this? Oh, Jesus.
It's the hard work. All right, the fifth role we came up with is a layout person. Someone that can actually convey sense and depth and all these things just by the way the document is created. We're not talking about what's on the page, but how it's on the page.
How it's on
the number of columns, where art's put, the type of background, the font they pick.
Well, see, that's another thing, too, is that you need a graphic designer. Now, maybe your artists are graphic designers. Maybe your layout person is your graphic designer. Maybe your project lead is a graphic designer. Doesn't matter. You need one. You need someone to create font. You need someone who can, like, the edges of the pages might have little designs on them to delineate the columns.
Right.
that just doesn't magically appear on the page, and you don't want to use clip art,
well,
for God's
and you
sakes.
Know, being relatively ignorant to this, because I don't have a background in graphic arts.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it.
I always just kind of blew this off, said it's no big deal, as long as it looks clean and professional, who cares? Until I sat down with someone who has a fine arts degree in this kind of stuff, and I mean, he was like, no, I mean, the human eye moves like this and it works like this. And if you do this, it creates this effect. And it's the more we start talking about, the more I realize, like, you know, on some subconscious level, I've always known this.
Yeah.
That I can see exactly what he's talking about, where I have responded a particular way to a certain book just because of how it presents itself. So this is something that's easy for the layperson to overlook, but it is important to have that book professionally laid out. So this is what we came up with for roles in the project.
Right.
And we don't want to release to you guys just yet what our full team roster is, because we're actually doing this in two phases.
Yeah.
Phase one is going to be when we develop the stripped down product that we're releasing along with these podcasts, which is what you're going to find in the resources section of the site. Phase two is when we're going to go for the more full blown professional product. Enough on the team. Let's push on ahead to what this show is actually about today, which is the feel of a role-playing game. We think this is where a lot of games fall off the track. We have said, if you listen to this show, that we believe 90% of the problems most people have in their role-playing game come from a failure at the group template. That your group doesn't have enough direction, doesn't have enough unity. You can drill this almost always down to a failure of the group template. And we have tried to build that thing up as the unsung important part of a role-playing game most people skip over. They go from, hey guys, let's play D&D to here's my character, let's begin.
Mm-hmm.
We think feel is the same thing in game design. That a lot of games, if you look at many of the problems they have in production and execution, comes from the fact that they skip from an idea to either setting or rules. They jump over this middle step of feel. So let's start by defining what is feel. We kick this around a lot, and we came up with all kinds of technical...
Oh boy, did we kick it around a lot. We kicked
two episodes full around.
And we came up with all kinds of super technical definitions of feel and philosophical statements. And what we really came up with is this. Feel is the overmaster of everything else you do.
Right.
Feel is that abstract emotional context a story carries that decides what's going to be in the setting, where the rules need to focus. It's basically saying when you play this game, I want you to get the sense that you're a superhero.
Right.
I want you to have the sense that you're a desperate adventurer in a dark world trying to work beneath the nose of a evil government. It's, take Star Wars. You know, I am that's the high adventurer at the fantasy field despite the science fiction technology. This is what feel is. And we actually, before we got on the mics for this third try, as we were trying to recollect our thoughts, started flipping through a bunch of game books.
Oh, did we?
And critiquing
steaming piles
where they sit on feel.
Or don't sit on feel.
A lot of the problems we found with these games all came back to this. Just like, once again, a lot of problems with role-playing games come back to that group template. They went off on feel. We recognize that games are meant to be diverse. That you can play a game that's dark and brooding, and you can also play a game that's happy-go-lucky and adventurous, all in the same setting. Okay, so do not confuse our take on feel with some kind of artificial limit we're trying to put on the games, or where we have some narrow view that there's only one right kind of game to happen in a particular setting, because that's not in any way, shape, or form what we're saying.
Right.
What we are saying is that if you look at Battletech, while you could play a game that covers many different subjects or many different experiences, ultimately the feel of Battletech is one of realism, one of sort of a resourcefulness or quiet desperation, and it's a story about human interactions. If you look at the story of Battletech, it's not about the mechs. It's about the personal interactions, the politics, the relationships, the backstabbing, the love, the hate. Mm-hmm. This is what it's about. And you can deviate from that for a particular story, but the universe still has that feel independent of your story. Look at real life. Yeah, I can have particular experiences where this stays happy and this stays sad, and my life, I'm sure, goes better or worse than the next person sitting over here. But ultimately, I still go through the same pain, the same self-doubt, the same search for significance, all these other factors that are common to the experiences of everyone on Earth. And in many ways, you could say that this is the feel of the real world. Just as when you're in Star Wars, sure, you could have a game that's about a family struggling to make it in the industrial slums of a core world, but you cannot escape the fact that outside of your view, all around you are Jedis and bounty hunters and all these things having their grand adventures and gallivanting around the galaxy. There is still that feel that binds it all together.
Right.
You know, another important thing feel does is it doesn't just define what is there, it defines what isn't there. Feel serves as an important guard on the setting. I really doubt there is a single person listening to this podcast who cannot say, I was a big fan of X until they did Y. For example, I was a really big fan of Battletech until they introduced the clans. Because Battletech was about, as I said before, that sort of quiet desperation, the need to be resourceful, kind of rundown industrial feel of the game. With the introduction of the clans, suddenly it became much more fast-paced, much more postmodern. And, you know, I don't want to get into this huge debate discussion about Battletech, but when they changed the whole feel of the game with that.
Yeah.
I thought they changed the feel of Star Trek with Voyager and Deep Space Nine. Because Star Trek was always about the mystery and the exploration and the science of it. Well, all of a sudden now they changed it to be really more about an interpersonal drama. And it forever changed the feel of that game. And so when you have this feel set out, you are saying that these are the elements that do not belong in my game. Because if they are in there, it will forever take away from that sense of context that people first fall in love with. Once again, don't hear this harder than I'm saying it. I'm not saying your setting can't evolve or change a little.
Or that you shouldn't have a setting at all.
We are simply saying that there should be some kind of boundary that says, this is the emotional experience I made for people to take away from it.
Setting is good, but it's not feel. And that's what we're trying to convey right now, is what is feel.
When we designed the feel document for Skies of Glass...
Well, wait. Let's explain... What is a field document?
Well, what a field document is just as with a group template, what we decided to do was kind of put in paper form what really should be an interpersonal process. And if you're new to the show, a group template is a step we recommended right before character creation where you say in this game, we want to pick some unifying concept for the party that guarantees we'll be headed in the same direction, doing the same things, generally getting along with each other. And so really, honestly, this is just a discussion you could have amongst friends that as long as you agree upon, you've got your group template. You don't need to fill out a form. Now, the field document is something similar, but because we're dealing with remote individuals and we're also trying to give you guys resource documents to look at, we decided to create a field document for Skies of Glass. Mm-hmm. Now, what you read in this field document is not what your game needs to be. We are not saying there's a right or wrong feel for a game. This is just the one we picked for our game. Now, your document would have things in it similar to ours, but they would not be the same because your game should probably have a different feel than Skies of Glass does. So don't take this as some kind of, you know, narrow elitism about the kinds of feel a game should have. So our feel document, all it does is we list out in a couple big bullet points, these are the kinds of emotions and concepts we want to be a central undercurrent to our game.
Mm-hmm.
For example,
or things that we implicitly don't want in the game.
The feel document is really, it's an internal working guideline. What I mean is that your feel document at no point should be stapled into your book for release.
Mm-hmm.
Feel is not something
you shouldn't have a page that says, this is Skies of Glass, and this is the feel of Skies of Glass.
No one should ever see this document but the people working on the game, but everyone should know what is written in this document.
Exactly.
It is just like narrative writing. You want to show people the feel, not tell them the feel. Mm-hmm. This should be there in every word you write and every piece of art you stick in there and every layout choice you make. That feel document should be sitting there perched atop your shoulder like some kind of little watching angel, but it should never actually appear in the things you do.
Right.
Now, for example, in the Skies of Glass field document, which we will be posting online, once again, the resources section, some of the things we put in there were realism. That was one thing we put in there.
How did you arrive at realism?
You know, some of this goes back to the concept of the game or the goal for when I set out to write the game. But I think realism, in my case, was really more of a reaction to what I didn't want in the game.
Okay.
That if I sit down, I look at the bulk...
The Spanish galleons.
Yeah. If I look at the bulk of post-nuclear things out there, and I won't say all because I know there's exceptions to this, but you look at the bulk of post-nuclear things out there, they all sit upon some kind of a mild or great absurdity.
Yeah.
That you have psychic mutants. Mind you, radiation destroys you. It gives you thyroid cancer. Yeah. It
doesn't give you fangs and wings and laser eyes.
Exactly.
Screw you.
It destroys
I'm Spider-Man.
You. Yeah. Even that 1/100, 1/10 of 1%, it still kills that person. It doesn't give them 3 eyes or whatever.
So one thing I wanted to do that I won't be so bold to say is unique or first, but is semi-unique or rare, is I wanted to base our writing off of the real scientific research into these areas, what FEMA says really happens when an A-bomb drops, what the medical community says radiation really does to you, what the scientific community says about how long radiation will even be there, which is not all that long, so on and so forth. I wanted this to be based on what an A-bomb fall would really be like. Something else we put in there was suffering. You can't tell a post-nuclear story without suffering being a central theme.
Right.
And so in everything we write, we want there to be some sense of desperation that people are struggling to survive from day to day. Juxtaposed to suffering, we want this to be a story about hope. Hope was another point in the field document. Because, yeah, bad things have happened, and bad things are still happening, but ultimately mankind is trying to get itself together and to build a better world.
Okay, we could go through every one of these points.
Which we're not going to.
How do you know when you have enough in this document?
That's a good question.
That's why I asked it.
Well, thank you for asking it.
How often do I ask you questions?
As of this, actually, in this episode, a couple, typically not very many.
Adam gets a cookie.
He does get a cookie. If this was the bonus episode, I'd put the bass back in his voice, but...
Jerk.
How do you know when you have enough? You know...
There's 9 points on our document. Why can't there be 11?
I think there could
be
11. Well, yeah. And... real quick, just an aside on that, your field document, especially during the early stages, should be flexible. Now, beyond that, it should not be, because if it's too flexible, what was the point of having it in the first place?
Well, everything should be based on your field document.
Right.
When you get to a certain point where you've written X amount of content and you start changing your field document, all that content that references that field document is going to need to change because
you know
it's wrong.
I would say, really, you know when you have enough, and this is a big-time fuzzy logic. This is at which hair loss does a person become balding. When
that's a new analogy.
I would take it back to your original objective that you created if you're working along with us from the last episode, where at some point you sat down and said, this is the kind of game I want to create. So at this point, you now have to boil that down to some kind of consistent
list of elements that you want in your game.
What elements does it take to create that kind of game? And in some cases, this may have just come down to personal pet peeve, that you may just say, these are the kinds of stories I want to tell, and these are the kinds of things that I hate in this genre and want to keep out. So I think it's hard to, there's no formula to this. But what I would say is if your game is too free, where you could stick in just any kinds of willy-nilly wild things in there, and that was not your intention, you don't have enough feel. If you have no room left to grow and evolve the setting, you have too much. So really, the feel should just be kind of a definition of these context and emotion type bullet points, saying this is what it will take to frame the setting properly for me to be able to tell the story and create the game I set out to do when I wrote down that objective that we described in the previous show. I think it's important also not just talk about what that feel document is, but the role that it's used in. We've talked about how the field document sets a sort of limiter on what you should and shouldn't put into the setting. We have also talked about how the field document serves as an undercurrent you always go back to. But, you know, I want to talk about how you express that field document in the story. Obviously, part of that is with the writing, but also this is something you should do with the art. I've played a lot of games where I could tell they were trying to get at deep RP, yet every single picture with some ripped guy or some chick in a bikini wielding a gigantic three-barreled gun in each hand with a grenade launcher on their back.
How is that not role-playing?
Yeah.
There are hot chicks in bikinis, Dan. That's real. They walk around all the time with guns and grenade launchers.
Well,
you just need
guns
to open your eyes to the larger world.
If there was a place like that on Earth, I would move there. And that's how I know there isn't a place like that.
Nice.
I thought there was, and I thought it was Australia, but then I found out that's not true.
No, they took the guns away. They still got the hot chicks.
In bikinis.
In the bikinis.
All the time.
All the time. Even in the bush, they got chicks in bikinis.
I'll leave it alone. And we can move on.
We've given our Australian listeners something to talk about. You've got to remember that with your art, you are setting a visual context on the world. You are giving people something. I mean, when they look at it on some subconscious level, they're internalizing that. And I think a lot of role-playing games miss the boat on that. And I have to wonder how much art direction there even really is. That they may say to these people, hey, here's the topics, draw something relevant. But do they really sit down and say, you know, this is how your art fits into the book? Your art is helping right. to tell our story, not just give images, yeah. not just fill out the book because okay. nobody
well,
likes all
the
words.
What happens is that when game companies design these games, they do not come up with a field document. So the artists have no direction on these types right. of things. The artists can almost directly come from the field document. You know, I got to filter that field document through the setting and then do their pictures.
And guess something I want to be sure we do with Skies of Glass is I do not want our art to just be pictures of guns and people flexing.
See, that's my problem with
explosions.
Explosions. I want to have pictures of a grandfather sitting with his granddaughter on a hillside over a farm.
With a row of skulls in front of him.
You're going to get 20 submissions of people who want to do art for this thing. And it's going to be a grandfather and a granddaughter on a field overlooking a farm.
I hope so.
I don't think we're going to have that problem.
Well, you know what I hate is, like, in Rifts, this is how I get back to...
back to Rifts.
Rifts has no feel. Rifts has a setting and everything else, but it has no feel. Is that you look at the art through it. Now, minus the cover. The cover is of some large monster or some big ripped guy or whatever. Beautiful picture. But you go inside of it, and the art is pretty good, nice clean lines, but it's vehicle, guy with a gun.
Yeah, we looked through the Rifts main book, and almost every, and if you like Rifts, that's fine. We're not critiquing
the game. I'm
really
sorry if you like Rifts.
If, when we flipped through that book, every single picture in there was almost without exception. There's a few exceptions, but mm-hmm. not many, was either something you can own.
Yes.
Or something you can kill. It was a magic spell you can cast, a gun, a suit of armor.
There was a third, like, kind of profile pose.
Yeah.
Like, where you.
The character class, the OCC.
You want this as the picture of your character where he's on fire.
He's on fire, flexing and guns.
Or I'm playing this OCC. Well, this OCC has lots of little talismans and bits hanging off them all over there.
What?
Yeah.
Not.
Talismans and bits.
Not that. I was talking about the character concept.
Oh, okay.
Moving on.
Leyline Walker.
All
lots
right,
of little
so
bits.
The point to this is that, once again, the art sets not just visual appeal to the book. It doesn't just illustrate the concepts, but it also, it is a part of telling the story. Mm-hmm. It sets the expectation, the desire of what's going to go on in the games. One thing that I would recommend in your field document is don't get too specific about setting. This is not a setting document. We are going to talk probably in the next episode or two about the setting and about creating your own internal list of do's and don'ts for the setting. That's not what this is. This is something that's meant to kind of frame and guide the setting. It's not meant to explain the setting in great detail, talking about this particular city or that particular piece of equipment or this one social group. I would also recommend that as you're writing the field document, if you need inspiration, think about what the people in your world are going through, what their daily life is like. That, as we talked about earlier, in the human experience in the real world, yes, there are many, many diverse cultures and diverse experiences and all these things, but there are some things that all of us have in common that we collectively call the human experience. That is what you would describe as the feel of life on Earth. And think about this for your people. What are the features of their daily life that they all have in common? And this is what you need to put down in your field document.
Feels kind of a hard thing to wrap your head around.
It is. You know,
takes a lot of discussion and debate.
Let's throw out a game that we think did feel extremely well. Legend of the Five Rings.
Yes.
And we are talking about the older edition, the one where it was still...
The very first edition of the role-playing
right.
game.
Not the D20 setting.
Yeah,
we're talking about,
I can't really talk about that because I've not seen it.
We've not seen it.
Yeah, it could be wonderful, but I haven't seen
it. So we're talking about the original D10 stuff.
You know what makes this game good? And I have serious complaints with one or two aspects of it. But what makes it a good game as far as feel goes is that when you flip through it, you look at the art, and the art just isn't a guy with a piece of equipment standing on a white background. It is people in a setting doing things. Even if it's just a quick action shot, even that action shot, you have people doing things in a place. As you flip through it, there's tons of fluff, tons of story. They use fonts in this sort of pseudo-Asian English script that they have going on. Edges of the pages are in this sort of Asian
scroll pattern.
Yeah, all these little things. Like,
you know, even one thing I remember about the game that I loved as a feature is, since it's set in feudal Japan.
Technically, it's not, but...
Well, it's that era.
Yeah, it's that Asian.
It's that era. It's a mythological setting. But just like you could say D&D is set in medieval Europe. I mean, that's what they're drawing from. And of course, because of that, you had to be really concerned about the court politics
right.
and your personal honor. And they didn't just say in black and white, you should be concerned about your personal honor. Here's 20 dishonorable actions. Here's 20 honorable actions. Here's an honor pool. Yeah. But instead, what they did was they actually walked through all the courtesies.
Mm-hmm.
Like how you, if you have a superior, you back away still facing him.
Right.
They walked through all these different terms in Japanese and all these little accoutrements and implements of the daily mm-hmm. court life. They did a lot to really take you there and help you visualize how this goes down in their world, not just a mechanical explanation, but almost like a trip through a museum.
Yeah, you don't have to be a fan of Japan to understand this game or a fan of Asian culture. Another cool thing that they did was with equipment. They had an entire page of equipment that had nothing to do with killing. It was all non-violent items that are just used in daily life that aren't even normal items. You know, they had all these sort of Asian objects, and they had them all in a picture, and they were all sitting there in all size next to each other. And then when you turn the page, they had a sort of black and white where all the items are blacked out, but you see the outline of it, and it's all numbered and referenced. And then you can look and you can read what each item is.
Historical explanations.
Yeah.
It's not like, here's the stats, here's the cost, here's the damage it does.
Yeah.
It actually kind of explained all these things. Yeah. Now, that may not be necessary in your game. Like us doing Skies of Glass.
We don't need to talk about a screwdriver. Everyone knows what a screwdriver is.
But these are the kinds of things. So we're not saying you need to do this particular way.
You know what?
But this game did it well for its setting.
You know what they did really cool? And it's the same concept as that equipment thing. They had armor, where they were talking about the different, very complex and ornate Japanese armors, right? And they talked about the rules aspects of it and stuff. And then they had a picture of all the armor laid out. But it wasn't a picture on a white background. It was like this blacksmith's armor shop. And there were trees, and there were people walking around, and the armor was hung. And you can look at it. It took up two pages, this big splash page, and you look at this whole thing. When you turn the page over, then it had that part where all the armor is just black outlines, and it's numbered, and then it tells you about the armor. It's cool that they tell you about the armor stuff, but then it gives you feel.
That's why I described the book as a museum, because it reminds me. Because you can go to a museum, see the exhibit, and look down. They have that little silhouetted outline with the numbers that tells you what everything in the exhibit is.
Right.
And I think something's important to point out here, and this is where we think Five Rings kind of dropped the ball, is your feel is important to your setting. But it is equally important to your rules, because the simple fact of the matter is, I realize some things in the world require more mechanics than other. Combat requires more mechanics than roleplay. It's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
But where you put the emphasis in the rules, it sends a message, a subconscious message to the players that this is what the game is all about.
Right.
So when we do Skies of Glass, we have said that we want the game to be about hope and despair and all these things. So we are going to focus a lot of our rule effort into your wounds and your health. Mm-hmm. Now, eventually, we are talking around and kicking around the idea, can we put out rules to develop civilian life?
Right.
Put out things that, like, help you simulate a farm. And not just, like, roll percentile dice for how much money you made, but, I mean, something that actually walks you through the steps of what you might go through.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know. This is just, this is all preliminary idea. But we want to put the rules where the emphasis of the game is supposed to be. And Five Rings kind of then drops the ball,
right?
Because all of its rules is about killing people.
Yeah. They have all of this stuff about the land and the people and the village life and the court life and what it's like for peasants. But guess what? You can't play any of that. You can only play a person who kills people with a sword or a person who kills people with magic. Then they came out with an expansion. You could play somebody who kills people with their fists. You cannot play a peasant. I tried. The rules do not allow you to play a peasant. They do not allow you to play a courtier. They do not allow you to play a fluff class. You can only play a killer.
That's okay. Bards suck.
Yeah. You couldn't play a bard in this unless he was a killer. You could play a guy with a sword who was a samurai or whatever their equivalent was, who also sang. You could play a magician
who
farmed on the side. Yeah, that's about what it was.
All right, let's move off.
Let's talk real quick about how would we leverage this. Let's say we have our field document, which in the case of Skies of Glass, we do. And now what we're trying to make sure is that we leverage this into the game. That let's say for a moment we had a game out there that had a great and wonderful field document. They just didn't get it into the game. How do we make sure that we get this in, that we get this in there?
Every step of the way. Everything we write, does this conform to our 9 points on the field document?
And, you know, I would say not just conform, but I would say does this forward those? Mm. And this is really one, it's hard for me to give you a formula here. You just need a lot of self-critique. Make sure everyone on your team has read the field document. Make sure everyone on your team consults it. Point back to it like your Bible. I mean, this is the book that you keep coming back to as this field document.
Right.
And not just, Adam, important point, it conforms to it, and it doesn't just conform to it. Does it forward this? If you want a high role-playing game, and you've got one page on civilian life, and the next 30 pages is a great big detailed scatter rules for grenade explosions, you've got to ask yourself,
you have failed.
Yeah, am I putting my effort where it needs to go? Now, if you're making a military game, maybe you need 30 pages of grenade scatter.
Maybe
because that's your feel.
Yeah.
And that's your feel, and you are forwarding that feel. And I think some of this just requires imagination. I can't teach creativity. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'll give Five Rings props for was they had some really imaginative ways of expanding on the setting.
Right.
You know, maybe there is a suggestion there. Don't base this off existing role-playing games.
Yeah.
Because I think feel is one of the areas many role-playing games have really dropped the ball on. And so maybe what you've got to do is draw your inspiration from a documentary or a museum, mm-hmm. or I don't even know what. I mean,
what did we draw Skies of Glass from?
A game?
Actually, no. The main thing I drew Skies of Glass from, if you want to know the actual inspiration, it was, I mean, it was kind of the game Wasteland that triggered that desire to develop it.
It was the game Wasteland where we were sitting around talking, wouldn't it be cool to play Wasteland?
Right.
But that was just the impetus.
You know, what really triggered the feel was reading a series of advisories that were released by some British department, one of the British defense departments or civilian departments, some stuff by FEMA. It was reading kind of what these wars are actually like. And I remember also checking out a few of the films that have been made about this, like The Day After, not to be confused with The Day After Tomorrow. But
one's about zombies.
No, one's
no,
about...
Day After Tomorrow.
One's about ecological disasters.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking of something else.
You think of 28 Days Later.
It's getting late.
It is.
There was a movie.
It's 2 minutes past my bedtime.
There was a movie in the 1980s about people surviving a nuclear war. And these are the kinds of things that inspired the feel of it, this super realism that, yeah, I think also it's just kind of personal axe to grind that I've always felt there's nothing wrong with the fantastic, mm-hmm. but I think people underestimate just how interesting the realistic really is.
Right.
That I have yet to read a story that moved me the way the story of the Doolittle Raid did. Once you actually get it in all of its detail and personality. Anything else on feel?
Feel good.
All right.
Feel bad.
That's their way of saying thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Time for bed.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.